Afternoon and welcome to today's theoretical extravaganza. Before we get into the substance of the panel discussion, I'd like to make three brief announcements. The first is that speaking next week on Tuesday is the director of the United Nations Association, Malcolm Harper, and he will be, and this will interest you, be speaking on how to find a job in the United Nations. This is next week, Tuesday, 12th of March, in the Royalty Theater at 5 p.m. Also speaking next week is Edward Vates, who is the UNDP resident representative for Palestine, and he will be speaking on the UNDP and nation building with special reference to Palestine. This will be next Thursday, March 14th at 1 p.m. in the Vera Anstey Room. And just finally, I'd like to welcome our guests from Brussels, who are here from the Brussels University as part of the LSE University of Brussels exchange program. So without further delay, we should go into the substance of today's panel discussion. Mr. Stern, Professor Hill, Dr. Rosenberg, and Mark Hoffman have all been kindly requested to give short opening presentations, which will summarize the points of view of their school of thought, and afterwards the rest of the time will be allocated to your questions. So we should turn then to our first speaker, Jeffrey Stern, who will be representing the School of Realism.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, I'd just like to make one or two caveats. Now, the realism which I'm prepared to defend is not that of Thucydides, it's not that of Machiavelli, it's not that of Hobbes, although it does owe something to all of them. Neither do I regard realism as the only valid way of looking at international relationships, nor is it intended to be prescriptive or predictive. It's a mode of analysis, and it is for others to determine the policy implication, if there are any. In fact, realism is to me no more than a methodology or set of working assumptions for reducing the complexities of international relationships to manageable proportions. As such, it doesn't have to be true necessarily, but like the tube map, it should be useful, helping one to find one's way around. So what kind of realist am I? I call myself a reconstructed realist in that I try to take account of recent economic, technological, political, and other changes affecting international relationships. But I suppose that reconstructed realism is a variant of what its critics call the English school, a mode of exposition developed at LSE by people like Hedley Ball, Fred Northedge, Jeffrey Goodwin, Alan James, as well as myself, all of us students of that idiosyncratic, if dissimilar, duo, Charles Manning and Martin White. We were all, as it were, Charlie's angels and Martin's angels as well. Now, unlike some of our LSE colleagues, we accepted that although knowledge is a unity, one needed to make a disciplined study of a segment of the knowable in order to make sense of the world. Social science as a whole was far too broad, whereas international relations, if given suitable definition, was an appropriate focus. We were realists insofar as, firstly, our concentration was state-centric, not that we regarded the state as invulnerable or impermeable, and we certainly didn't regard non-state actors as if they were of no account. It was just that, if the study were to be revealing, it had to have a sharp focus, and ours was on the sovereign state in interaction, although not to the neglect of other inter- and transnational actors. Secondly, we also saw state policy as being concerned with the pursuit of interests, at one time conceived of dynastically, nowadays generally understood more broadly, if ambiguously, as national in intent and involving the search for security, welfare, and prestige. Thirdly, although we accepted that policy is one, we drew a distinction between its domestic and international dimensions, since the latter, directed at and pursued in an arena beyond the state's jurisdiction, was generally a more secretive process and the province of a much smaller coterie of specialists. And fourthly, whether or not we use the ambiguous term power, we accepted that for success in foreign policy, decision makers had to choose the most appropriate pressure or inducement for the end in view, economic, military, diplomatic, or whatever. Unlike the classical realists, we of the English school, mindful of the many ambiguities at the heart of our study, stressed the importance of linguistic analysis, that is to say, the elucidation of concepts. Such analysis, we felt, was especially important in discussion of the state, since although people perform roles in its service, the state is nothing but a personified abstraction with territorial, political, and legal implications. The state acts, but no one has ever seen it act because its existence is purely notional. It exists in the world of the in effect, not in the world of the in fact. For example, we speak now of mounting tension between Cuba and the United States. The reality is, of course, of statements and actions by a few people conducted in the name of these two entities following the incident in which armed officials claiming to represent Cuba shot down two intrusive aircraft piloted by Cuban exiles. Now, it could be that the majority of people in both countries are quite unconcerned about the incident, or that the anger attributed to their officials is synthetic. Nonetheless, what people perceive can be, for realists, as politically significant as what actually happens, which is why the perception of mounting tension between Cuba and the US is, for a realist, meaningful. In a further modification to classical realism, we of the English school describe the international milieu as an ordered anarchy, anarchic in that power is dispersed and there is no global government or widespread sense of international solidarity, ordered in that such institutions as diplomacy, international law, international organizations, and power balances, as well as internal constraints, provide a framework for regular international interaction. That is why we could talk about a society of states, even though in this context the term society is as hypothetical as is the state itself. Yet another modification concerns the role of morality. Classical realism put international relations beyond the realm of ethical judgment. Not so the English school. However, as against many post-behaviorists, any moral judgment we make would be based on contextual or situational considerations that in turn would depend on an understanding of the particular context in which a state finds itself. One would not, for example, expect a dissatisfied power to inhabit quite the same moral universe as a satisfied power. Terrorism, for example, is the instrument largely of the aggrieved, not of the contented. Finally, some correctives to the customary caricature of realism. Firstly, since Kautilya and Sun Tzu, among its founders, have their modern counterparts in many a non-Western university and foreign office, realism cannot be dismissed as simply a Western plot. Secondly, it cannot be assumed that its advocates are enthusiasts for the kind of world that they depict. After all, one of the co-founders of the English school, Martin White, was a pacifist who deplored the international political processes he so graphically described. Nor can it be presumed that realists are necessarily pessimists, despairing of the possibility of reform and believing that international politics have to be characterized by incessant war. True, they hold that the scope and the scale of change are necessarily limited, but are sometimes more optimistic than their critics as regards the possibilities of reducing international turbulence, at least in the short term. In fact, most modern realists believe that an accommodation between antagonists is always possible, as long as the issues in contention are perceived as interests and not sacred principles. For while interests are negotiable, sacred principles are not, and one cannot do deals with great Satans, children of darkness, or evil empires. Finally, precisely because of their interests, or their emphasis on interests, realists see absolutely nothing wrong in settling for palliatives rather than cures. While they may be skeptical of cure-alls, such as collective security, federalism, functionalism, disarmament, and the like, they accept the logic of addressing with a view to easing the kinds of tensions that can escalate into open warfare. There now, it doesn't sound quite so bad, does it?
Thank you, Mr. Stern. We now turn to Professor Hill, who will be doing the School of Pluralism.
Well, Stefan, I think I'm very cross with you, really, because, first of all, you've made me follow Jeffrey Stern. And there are a number of things I'd like to say about Jeffrey's presentation, but I think I'll keep those for the discussion. But I think that it was, I think, as good a job as you could do in 8 minutes. The second thing I'm cross with you about is the fact that I'm obviously put on the old man side of this stage. And I'm the one with the white hair, and he's not. Even though he's older. Quite a bit older. And the third is that you've inveigled me into this theoretical extravaganza when everyone knows that I'm really a historian. So I've got quite quite a task on my hands. Anyway, you did allow me to do one thing, and that was to describe the school of thought which I was going to talk about and defend to a degree, and I called it pluralism because it's easier to cope with than liberalism. Explain why in a moment. Pluralism is a notion which is more familiar really to students of government or mainstream political science and international relations. It tends to be associated with the opposite of elitism, a view that interest groups, associations, and complex political processes help us to understand the nature of politics within the state better than the idea that it's run by a single oligarchy or elite. It is a word that's crept into international relations in terms of the famous paradigms, and it is often substituted for the word liberalism or rationalism as the kind of meat in the sandwich between realism and structuralism, and it is rather a big category. It has to be accepted. However, I prefer it to the more common liberalism, or indeed possibly rationalism or Grotianism, things which Jeffreys to some extent annexed, I think, in his remarks just now, because I think liberalism is a word which is very much open to wide interpretation. I mean, not only is it often the name of a political philosophy and a set of and a political party, and they vary, obviously. Liberals can be very conservative people in different countries of the world. But it also brings together economic liberalism and political liberalism, and we all know that Mrs. Thatcher, for example, was an economic liberal, but not very liberal in some of her attitudes on social and political matters. And I think that, therefore, it's very difficult to stick with that without constantly redefining one's terms and trying to get out of political corners into which one has either painted oneself or been painted. It's also the case that with liberalism, I think the normative aspects tend to be too much to the fore, and although normative aspects are always there in all this, and we have to face up to the normative implications of our particular school of thought, and I'll try to do that in a moment with pluralism, they tend to get in the way of reasoned analysis in this particular case. Now, what does pluralism in the context of international relations mean? I think that there are five points that I would like to draw your attention to in the short time at my disposal. The first is complexity. I suppose it's a truism to say that everything in the world is complex. It's very difficult to understand. There are a lot of facts out there. There are a lot of processes. But what we're saying when we say that a process is complex in more than a trivial way, I think, is to say that any attempt to understand it, any explanation, must take into account a multifactorial approach. Or to put it more strongly, that we certainly don't favour a single factor explanation to very many events in the world. And therefore, we need, if we want to understand, and I take it just for the moment that our aim is to understand, leaving on one side the understanding-explanation dichotomy, but that we want to know, the causes of things, why things broadly happen, we have to accept that the answers are not easy. Now, partly, intellectuals have a vested interest in saying that things are not easy because it's a way of putting a distance between them and the rest of the world. And there is, of course, the elegance and simplicity of its some of the great breakthroughs which one reaches after understanding of complexity. But I think people who haven't accepted complexity and gone through it simply end up with simple-mindedness. It is also true, I think, en passant, that it is very important to be able to explain complex things in a comprehensible, if not simplistic, way, and to see some of the essential qualities of an explanation. Anyway, a pluralist is likely to emphasize the complexity of events and causation. The second point I want to make is to say that pluralism is going to emphasize actors and agents probably more than structures. Now, as Jeffrey has suggested with realism, it'd be foolish to come down on one side of the coin on one side of the argument when you get these dichotomies. Clearly, in order to try and make sense of the world, we need to focus both on the major actors and to decide who they are, and we also need to think about the structures and the sets of constraints, the long-term processes within which they operate, and we need to think about the interactions between them. But certainly the pluralist would want to say that it matters who you are and where you're positioned and for whom you are responsible, that there are real choices to be made which are more than simply illusory ways of allowing the great forces of history to feed through, and that it matters who is in what position at any given time. Now, in one of my own professional areas of activity, foreign policy analysis, I think this is absolutely taken for granted. If we didn't have a foreign policy analysis course in this school, in international relations department, we wouldn't have very much opportunity for focusing on the actors in world politics. Well, there would be opportunities, but there certainly wouldn't be an opportunity to focus on them quite so sharply and to particularly look at the operations of states and the decision-making processes of states. That allows us in turn to look at the role of personalities, the role of perceptions, the role of the different parts of the bureaucracy, the role of domestic politics, and so on. If we're talking in grand terms, as so much of international relations does, about the international political system, or about the international political economy, or about the Mediterranean world, or whatever generalization that we might come up with historically, we are likely to miss the fine textured quality of the actual dilemmas and the actual choices which have faced real-life people with political responsibilities. And unless we are prepared to believe, looking back historically and at the present, that these people have really been living in cloud cuckoo land and that their choices were illusory, I think it behoves us to try and analyze the degrees of constraint and the areas of space which they actually inhabited. The third point I wish to make very, very quickly is that the system, the pluralist, emphasizes a mixed actor pictures. That is to say, if you're a pluralist, you are not state-centric. You believe that the understanding of world politics must take into account non-state actors, not just the big obvious ones which are rivals to states, but individual citizens, people within the state that sometimes act transnationally and sometimes act on governments. And I think that this is a very important picture, because it's possible to finesse realism, as Jeffrey has rather skillfully done, by saying that we take into account the transnational dimension, that we've never left it out, but basically states are the only actor. I, in fact, might agree with him that states are the principal actor at this present time, but that I would certainly want to say that there are some very important other ones as well. The fourth point of my position is to say that there are, and I suppose I've said this already in some sense, there are no iron laws. There are variations over time. Periodicity matters. Particularity matters. Context matters. Fifthly, the pluralist has a normative inclination, of course. The normative inclination here is towards inclusiveness, towards an open-ended approach, towards emphasizing processes, cross-cutting cleavages, and open-ended jurisdictions. Indeed, there might even be thought to be some affiliations with postmodernism here. There is an emphasis on multilateral procedures rather than studying simply bilateral relations in interstate relations. There is a willingness to consider at least the possibilities of integration, of cooperation, as well as conflict. I haven't got time to give you a case study, which I was going to do, but I will perhaps leave that for the discussion, try and answer the question, why was there a European integration process after 1945, and say how you need a pluralist approach to answer it, a combination of factors in order to give a sensible answer to that factor. And I will finish by saying, answering in advance one of the criticisms that might be going through your mind, which is pluralism simply like human rights or apple pie, something that we all like and are in favor of, but it actually means very little. It doesn't help us to deal with the difficult choices about the really important things that determine politics. I say that the answer to that is guilty as charged in part. But as Churchill once said about democracy, it's the worst system we have apart from all the others. It's, in other words, pluralism is not a very sexy approach to explanation. It's not a particularly fashionable commodity, intellectual commodity, like both neorealism and postmodernism have been in recent years. But I would contend that a pluralist is nearer, is going to get nearer to, through hard work and a recognition of complexity, to the actual truth of how human beings behave and to an understanding of the courses of history than those people that tend to be reductionist and fall back on single factor approaches.
Thank you very much. Dr. Rosenberg, Marxist structuralism.
Thank you, Stefan. I have to begin with a confession. I'm not going to defend structuralism. I can't, in all honesty, defend it. I can't actually make intellectual sense of a category which includes in the same box the ideas of Kenneth Waltz and Karl Marx. I just can't see what those two characters have in common. And in fact, I have to tell you, a couple of years ago, I was at a conference where the arch-structuralist Emmanuel Wallerstein was giving a presentation, and to everybody's horror, he stood up and said, "What is this thing called structuralism?" He'd never heard of it. And yet, of course, we regard him as the central structuralist figure in international relations. But I'm going to defend something which usually goes under the heading of structuralism, namely Marxism, because I think that Marxism provides explanations of the central themes of international relations of a kind which the discipline and we as people need in order to make sense of the world around us. Now, the starting point of Marxism, I think, has to be a sense of history, an awareness that the world that you and I were born into, which we study in international relations, and which we assume to be normal, is in fact not normal at all. The world of a global sovereign state system and a world market, of endless technological development and demographic explosions, of national self-determination and social revolutions, all this is largely a creation of the last 200 years since the Industrial Revolution and the French Revolution. There has never been anything like it before in human history. And on top of that, we're not really sure where it's going, whether it will ultimately prove the gateway to a better world or whether it'll end in disaster. It seems to me then that what we therefore need, first of all, is to understand why human history has taken off in this extraordinary way and what it is that is generating the momentum of social development which has brought the modern international system into being. And that, I think, is what Karl Marx tried to do. Marx, it needs to be said 100 times, was not an economist. Marx was a philosopher and a social thinker who asked himself a simple question. What has changed about human society that could explain all these new developments? Because in the end, all these phenomena surely have to be expressions of new forms of human agency. And Marx's answer was that these things were indeed rooted in a new kind of society based on what he called the capitalist mode of production. And he then tried to show how the most distinctive features of the modern world were in fact expressions of these new social relations. Now, how is this so? Capitalism is a kind of society. It's a society based on the exploitation of people. Well, so were many other societies in history. What makes capitalism different is the form in which this is done. And I think it can be shown that it's this particular social form of capitalist relations which lies behind both the sovereign institutional form of the state in modern international relations and the developmental dynamic of the modern international system. But in order to explain this, I'd like if we could ask ourselves a question to focus the issue. And the question would be, what is the basic difference between modern capitalist society and, say, the society of feudal Europe? In medieval Europe, the feudal lord had a legal political right to force the peasant to work on his land. by violence if necessary. That was how he got the surplus out of the peasant, who would otherwise have survived perfectly well on his own land. If you compare that with our position in this society, we of course can't survive on our own in a capitalist society. We don't, as you and I as individuals, we don't have any land, and therefore we have to sell our labour power to some employer who calculates that he can make a profit out of us in order to get the wherewithal to live. And because we are dependent, we can be exploited by purely private economic means. Unlike in feudalism, where the lord used his political authority to exploit people, exploitation has now been privatized or depoliticized. And as a result of that, the other side of that same coin is that politics is now something separate and public, which stands outside the private sphere of the market. It has become instead of being a position of feudal authority, it has become the sovereign state. And what I think that shows, and what Marx argued, was that the historical emergence of the sovereign state, which we study in international relations, and the emergence of the private sphere of the market are in fact two sides of the same thing. They are both part of the emergence of capitalism. And in fact, when you think about it, the possibility of a sovereign state system in which states recognize each other as politically independent itself rests on the existence of privatized forms of ownership and economic power which can extend across state borders. I say it rests on it because without that, the only way of expanding international power would be by territorial expansion. That's why, of course, pre-modern international systems nearly always took the form of territorial empires. And it's also why the American empire of today, which in its penetration into just about every society on earth is surely the greatest empire in history, is also almost completely invisible in territorial terms. So on the one hand, Marx argued that the peculiar social relations of capitalism stood behind the institutional form of the modern state. But he also had a lot to say about the dynamics of those relations themselves. And I'd like to just mention a couple of them and say how I think they underlie the history of the international system, which we study in international relations. Let me just mention three very quickly. First of all, because the wealth that is generated in a capitalist society cannot be realized until the products are sold, the growth of capitalism creates a pressure to expand geographically in search of new markets. In fact, it was largely this thirst for markets which brought the global international system of today into being through, of course, the imperialist expansion of Europe. Secondly, because production in a capitalist society is organized by individual units, firms, which compete over price to capture market shares and then go out of business if they can't remain competitive, there's an inbuilt dynamic of technological innovation as firms are driven endlessly to raise the productivity of the labor that they're exploiting. But the same endless competition that produces all this technological dynamism also means that capitalism never knows when to stop. So it drives itself repeatedly into crises of overproduction. The rhythm of modern world history is to some extent dominated by the repetitive cycles of booms punctuated by slumps in which the market collapses, societies implode, and political crises ensue. In fact, the 20 years crisis, which culminated in the Second World War and which has done so much to influence the study of international relations in the 20th century, was of course centered historically on a massive capitalist slump. The historian Eric Hobsbawm recently wrote that the gates to the Second World War were opened in 1931, by which he meant, if you want to understand what finally brought fascism to power in Germany, then look at the impact of this slump on German society. And thirdly, because of course capitalist social relations remain basically exploitative, that generates profound social conflict both domestically and internationally. In fact, for the last 50 years, international relations have been dominated by one such conflict thrown up by the resistance to the spread of capitalism, namely the Cold War, which, let's not forget, generated a nuclear arms race that brought humanity to the brink of self-destruction. It's a runaway world, but it's one that's driven by very definite kinds of social relations. It's therefore possible, in principle, to understand and possibly to change it. which brings me to my last point, which is about socialism. Why do I still regard myself as a socialist in the 1990s, after the collapse of Soviet communism? Is it because I have a blueprint for a perfect society? No. Is it because I think that capitalism is approaching its final crisis and the revolution is approaching? No. Is it because I'm optimistic about human nature and think that if we could only overthrow the present system, things would be better? No, I don't believe any of these things. So why then do I still call myself a socialist? It comes down very simply to this. One of the reasons for trying to make sense of the world through social science is to understand how we can organize our society in such a way as to enlarge the realm of human freedom, both the individual freedom of people from oppressive relationships and the collective freedom of society from blind forces such as the market or indeed the balance of power, which ultimately threaten our continued existence on this planet. If you have this concern for emancipation, then you have to ask, emancipation of whom, from what, by what means? And that means you have to analyze the actual existing structures of power in the world. Now, not all structures of power in the contemporary world are capitalist, but the dominant ones, the ones that show up centrally in international relations, like the sovereign state system with its wars and the world market with its poverty in the midst of plenty and its ecological devastation, most certainly are. To think really critically about these things is therefore inevitably to think about transcending capitalism. And that's what socialism is. Socialism in that respect is not a dead letter. It is in fact the horizon of human hope in a capitalist age. It is, I think, the necessary name of any transformative politics that addresses seriously the central human questions of our time.
Thank you, Dr. Rosenberg. And finally for today, Mark Hoffman on critical theory.
I have an important caveat to make, which Stefan didn't mention at the beginning, and that is for family reasons, domestic reasons. I'm actually going to have to leave at 6:15, and since we were actually all meant to speak only for 5 minutes, that we're supposed to leave time for some questions. But anyhow, critical international theory. I mean, Justin will, in any case, sort of amply defend post-positivist forms of social theory, which there's considerable sympathy with regard to what we do. Critical international theory is a new development in international political theory that dates roughly from the sort of early to mid-1980s. In its widest sense, it includes theory that's informed by Habermas and the Frankfurt School, various forms of postmodernism and feminist political theory. In its narrowest sense, it refers specifically to Habermasian informed forms of political theory. I want to refer to it and think about it in terms of the wider sense, that is sort of the conjunction of the kinds of theories that one finds in critical theory, postmodernism, and feminist international theory. What these orientations all share at the beginning is an anti-foundationalism. That is a view that there is no Archimedean point from which we can understand and view the social world, that we live in a world of contingency, though the account of contingency varies in terms of how radical these various theorists take it. And that this radical contingency affects, therefore, the kinds of theorizing we are able to engage in and the forms of social practice institutions that we can pursue. It takes seriously the idea that we need to explore the links between social forces, ideas, and social institutions and practices. In other words, between agents, structures, and processes. And look at them in a complex manner and to interrogate them, both in terms of their historicity, as well as the possibilities imminent within them for social change and transformation. So in other words, critical theory has both a normative and a praxeological orientation in terms of trying to look at the world that we live in and what are the possibilities for change and transformation. It does so in a sense by trying to focus on the tensions that exist between universalism and particularism, and particularly about the systems of inclusion and exclusion which we have constructed and the kind of work that they do. Obviously, it has deep intellectual roots in terms of the Enlightenment tradition of thought, particularly the Enlightenment tradition with regard to the notion of critique, linked to the realization of ideas of human freedom, emancipation, and enlightenment, widely associated first with the work of Immanuel Kant and then carried through by a variety of social and political theorists from Hegel, Marx, Nietzsche onwards. Most importantly, it's concerned to realize the unfinished potential of the project of the Enlightenment of modernity, particularly with especially making clear the manner in which we have limited the possibilities for this realization through the technical instrumental forms of reason and rationality. So in other words, in the words of Foucault, it seeks to enable and produce a rational critique of rationality. And it does so through an exploration and understanding of what social forms and practices have served to constrain the realization of political emancipation. So therefore, it means it has a third component, which is that it is historical. And most importantly, it seems to me that one of the huge implications of this is that it links international relations back into social and political theory, rather than seeing it as something separate and distinct from it. And that we need to take on board the wide debates in social and political theory in thinking about international, while at the same time noting the importance of the international in thinking about social and political theory. Most importantly, it means that Martin White was wrong when he claimed that there was no international political theory. It seems to me that critical theory entails four kinds of critique. The first of these is normative. The normative critique includes a critical engagement with the contemporary social world, recognizing that the existing state of affairs does not exist all possibilities of social forms and social practices. Secondly, it entails a critique of historicization or engagement with history in terms of trying to provide a critical account of the historical and cultural conditions on which the theorist's own intellectual activities and practices depend, as well as the social forms and practices they produce. Third and most importantly, it entails a process of denaturalization. In other words, a continuous re-examination of the constitutive categories, conceptual frameworks that theorists use, including their historical construction of those frameworks and their implications. In other words, we'd look at things like the notion of the sovereign state that lies at the heart of Jeffrey's form of realism and try and ask how and in what ways this kind of discourse, even if Jeffrey wants to say it is only a discourse, came into being and what kind of work it does. Fourthly, it entails an open textured feature. That is, in terms of its critical confrontation with the work of social explanation and social practice, it doesn't take anything as given. It has no fixed terminus. There is no final answer to the questions we might ask. Everything is open to critical engagement and critical interrogation. It entails a positive orientation as a result of these towards forms of social practice. In other words, it has a deep praxeological content to it. The implications, it seems for me, in terms of international relations are huge in terms of the kind of reinscribing and restructuring it entails with regard to international relations, in terms of its central questions, its central categories, its core concerns, its actors, and its issues. And most importantly, and this is where the sympathy with Justin's project lies, is it seeks to displace the anarchy problematique with a question regarding the nature of modernity itself. And this leads me to the last comments I want to make, which is that anything the other three forms can do, critical theory can do better. With regard to realism, it takes on board everything that Jeffrey has said, but more importantly, it takes the state seriously as a sociological phenomena, and not simply privileging the legalist as-if discourses that reconstructed realism would want to enable, nor essentializing it in terms of its categories and practices with regard to something like the balance of power. But it also would take seriously the notion of the market, something we haven't discussed, there's no IP represented, and the manner in which these things constitute huge steering mechanisms that constrain the possibility of political emancipation. Secondly, with regard to pluralism, we would want to take seriously all the kinds of trajectories that Chris Hill talked about, but nevertheless would not locate these within the anarchy problematique. In other words, would take seriously and follow through their implications in terms of saying what's at stake is the question of modernity itself. Finally, with regard to historical materialism, it would share huge affinities with what Justin described and outlined. But most importantly, the break would come in not characterizing modernity as only capitalism. In other words, the distinctive category of distinctive features of modernity cannot themselves be limited solely to the question of the nature of capitalism itself. In a sense, what it would want to do is pick up on the kinds of things that Justin talked about at the ends in his answer to his question why he was a socialist, in terms of actually placing normative concerns at the front of the agenda rather than a kind of tack-on concern at the end. And I'm going to have to disappear almost immediately as a result.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. The floor is now open to questions. It's up to you to entangle all the different paradigms. You can ask questions to any individual or group of individuals. The only request we make is that you use the floor microphones that are available by our stewards so that your questions are audible to everybody. And if there is anybody who in particular wants to ask a question about critical theory, perhaps they could make themselves known. If not, we'll take whatever questions come up. Okay, Mr. Hoffman will have to leave, so we will...
You can hear it tomorrow at 2 o'clock. You get the one-hour version of it.
Are there any questions, then, to any of the speakers?
Wow.
Yes, the gentleman in the light top. Could you just wait until a floor microphone? There should be somebody down there with a microphone.
Not the way I define it. The point is, first of all, it's anarchic, not in the sense of chaotic. It's anarchic simply in the sense that there is no world government. It's anarchy in that sense. I mean, anarchy has two meanings. One is chaos. The second meaning is lacking government. Well, of course, international relations does lack government, so it's anarchic in that sense. But it is ordered in the sense that though there is no government, there are regimes, there are ways of doing things. Diplomacy, international law, international institutions, what I would call the rules of the game are also important. For example, you'll remember that in 1961, the Germans built, or the East Germans, built a wall. Now, I'm so old, I happened to have been in East Berlin when that wall went up. And I can tell you, I could have knocked it over myself. It was just a flimsy wall, and that anybody with an ounce of strength could have knocked it over. The interesting thing is that nobody did knock it over, because I think one of the rules of the game that was accepted is that you do not interfere in each other's spheres of influence. So there are international laws, there are international institutions, there's diplomacy, there are rules of the game, international organizations, and the balance of power, and if you like, great power management. All these bring an element of order into what otherwise might be chaotic. So that's why I say that we have a system which is both anarchic, because there's no government, but ordered in that there are mechanisms for bringing about at least a modicum of order in international relationships. Does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you. Okay. Can I say something about that?
Sure.
I think since the anarchy problematique has come up on the other side of this stage several times, it might be worth trying to put it into another context. And Geoffrey has done that to a degree from his own particular point of view. I think that because one focuses on international relations and accepts that there might be something distinctive about the international, and I think we heard Mark Hoffman, now I can say what I like about him now that he's gone, concede that point. That doesn't mean to say that one is absolutely committed to the view that anarchy is the dominant characteristic of international relations, and that there is a sharp distinction between what goes on in a world of states without superordinate political regimes and the world within the state, which, as we all know, is subject to proper constitutional processes. I mean, you don't have to know much about politics to realize that that distinction is overdrawn. You don't even have to be a pluralist to realize that there are many states in which the elements of disorder are pretty prominent, and there are many parts of international relations where the elements of routine and regime are fairly much to the fore as well. What is interesting, and those of us, all of us who work in an international relations department and regard it from the viewpoint of more than being simply a way of earning our salary, but something which is worthwhile doing, would, I think, agree with this from whatever point of view we come to, that there is something inherently interesting about the relationships between separate communities, which usually regard themselves as foreign to each other in some sense. Now, that the notion of foreignness is being reconstructed and redefined all the time. That's what's interesting about it. And a foreign policy between, say, Belgium and the Netherlands might not be a foreign policy worthy of the name from the point of view of the anarchy problematizer. But nonetheless, broadly speaking, international relations is about how separate communities interrelate, sometimes formally, sometimes informally, sometimes through violence, sometimes through the most courtly kind of rituals, which would be worthy of a domestic situation. But it is rather different from that in which a particular community has got many generations of tradition, institutions, culture, and territorial identity. And I don't think that it's too much to claim that there is still quite a big difference between relations between communities which regard themselves as separate from each other, if not foreign, and the kinds of activity that takes place within a reasonably well-established community. And until that difference breaks down completely, there will always be something called international relations. When it has broken down, there'll just be something called politics, and that's fine.
Could I add something to that?
Of course.
Just get my two ha'porths worth in about anarchy. When I was interviewed for my job in this department, one of the members of the panel was Professor Lord Meghnad Desai, and he bowled one of those questions at me that I would have paid a fortune not to have to try and answer. He said, it's a very interesting thing that in international relations there is this central intellectual theme of anarchy. Now, I'm an economist, he said, and in the field of economics we also have a central intellectual theme of anarchy, namely the anarchy of the market. Can you explain the connection between these two? And of course I couldn't at the time. But I can't set it out in detail now, but what struck me about it and what has strikes me as significant about this is that we tend to assume that this problematic of anarchy, the idea of an emergent order in social relations without the operation of a superordinate political authority, is something which distinguishes the international system from the sphere of domestic life. And on the other hand, that it has characterized the international system throughout history. And the more I've thought about this, the more it seemed to me that that is actually completely inside out. That if you look at the emergence of modern social thought, social theory, more, not just Marx, but all the classical sociologists, one of the things that they're all trying to explain in the emergence of modern society is how it can come about that a kind of society is emerging which is no longer dependent on hierarchical forms of political domination. And the more I thought about that, the more it seemed to me that actually anarchy was perhaps the central theme of modern classical social theory. And on the other hand, it wasn't something restricted to the international system, to international relations at all. And furthermore, if you go back in international thought, beyond the emergence of the modern international system, of course anarchy is not a theme that you find explicitly theorized about in the writings of pre-modern thinkers about international relations. So it may be that the theme of anarchy actually has a lot more to do with modernity and capitalism than it does with what makes the international different from domestic.
Can I just add one further word? And that is that so often what happens is that the international system at war is compared with an orderly domestic society. But if you compare international relations, say, with the domestic order, so-called, that obtains in Afghanistan or in Rwanda or in Somalia, you'll find that there's rather more order obtaining internationally than there is within those states. And if you take a country like Sri Lanka, you'll find that it is more reliable in its foreign dealings than the government is in its domestic dealings. And indeed, the government finds it difficult to rule domestically, but doesn't find it all that difficult to honor its international obligations. So you might say that in certain circumstances, there's more order obtaining internationally than there is within quite a number of domestic societies.
I think you had a question. Oh, who's it directed to? Everybody or? Yeah.
Shall I start off? I mean, it's obviously true that a great deal of conflict, violence and otherwise, takes place within side states. That's what we've been talking about partly the last few minutes. It's also true that a great deal of it overlaps the conventional boundaries between states. communities which regard themselves as foreign to each other. So to that extent, it doesn't make sense to have a sharp distinction between people who study domestic conflicts, as it were, or domestic political conflict, and those who study international conflicts. And a place like the LSE is ideal for a kind of interdisciplinary approach, which makes it possible to put those things together. And it's possible in the future we might have a center for research into conflict resolution and so on. Plenty of people Mark Hoffman or Michael Banks have been interested in the processes of conflict resolution. There's a quite perfectly honorable and active strand in intellectual life in international relations, but not just international relations, which has said, as you know, let's look at the nature of conflict as it presents in the international sphere, as it presents in the industrial sphere, and so on, and so on. But I think we should be very careful to, before we make assumptions that even interstate war is finished, and that's a kind of old-fashioned or redundant way of conducting things. I mean, we have made those mistakes before, not just in the 19th century, the long century of peace, but also in recent decades when there have been too easy assumptions about the way in which Western interdependence has taken over the nature of global politics, and there was no need for war. There was, if any war happened, it would be irrational, that boundary problems no longer existed, and so on. This in the age in which most of the boundaries of the world states are transparently artificial as a result of colonialization, and in which the very nature of inter-ethnic, inter-communal disputes is tied up with the nature of the territorial settlements created rather artificially in the wake of war and colonialization. So, in general, when things happen like the Gulf War or the Falklands War, or even wars in the Balkans where conventional territorial aggrandizement was actually present together with highly complex, savage intercommunal disputes, it's not generally surprising. It's surprising in the particular because many of us don't predict the particular conflict. But it is not at all to an international relations professional surprising that these things should, as a category, still be rather prominent.
Anybody else want to go for that one?
Okay, I mean, I think on the question of theory, I mean, you've got basically, I think, two kinds of theories on this very point. You have the pluralists who do talk about the breakdown of existing states, and you've got people like James Rosenau, who's written on deviance and terrorism. You have Anthony Smith, who talks about nationalism and ethnicity in the context of secessionism. So pluralists, I think, tend to write about the breakdown of existing states. Realists, like Peter Lyon, who wrote a book on new states and world politics, tend to concentrate on the creation of new states. So I think they're both looking at the problem of the breakdown of states and the creation of new states. But the realists will tend to stress the number of new states that are appearing and make the point that in 1945 were something like 55, 56 states. Now there are 185 in the United Nations, and then there's Switzerland, so that makes it 186, and probably Macedonia as well, so that makes it 187. So we've nearly quadrupled the number of states since 1945. That's something the realist would pick up on. The pluralist would be rather less interested in the creation of new states, rather more interested in how old states break down.
I think you had a question.
Thank you.
Shall we take the second question first, then?
Okay. Critical theory is a term that seems to have quite a lot of different meanings that shade into each other unpredictably at times. Its roots, of course, do lie within Western Marxism, but there is, at the opposite extreme, a much more general definition of critical theory which I associate with the writer Robert Cox, where he simply says that there is theory that is about solving problems within existing political frameworks, and there is theory which is about questioning those political frameworks themselves. Now, I think that if one is going to have a very general definition of critical theory like the latter one, then you could say that Marxism is a critical theory. But that's not enough, of course, because by doing that, by saying that Marxism is only one among a number of different critical theories, you're then left with the problem that all these other critical theories have completely different understandings of the world, of how power is organized in modern societies and what has to be done in order to improve it. So I share your confusion about whether this is whether it really gets us anywhere to say that critical theory can incorporate Marxism.
Should we then turn to the views of future?
Right. One of the points that I made in my address was that I don't regard realism as, I said I regard it as a mode of analysis, and it's up to others to determine policy implications, if any. And I think I followed in the tradition of the people who taught me. I didn't know that Martin White was a pacifist. I didn't know that Alan James was a pacifist. I didn't know that Fred North Edge was a socialist. And I didn't know that Charles Manning was a defender of apartheid. I mean, the fact of the matter is that they kept their political views quite away from the podium, as on the whole I try to do. I hope students actually don't know what my political views are.
Well, you're being asked for them now. Why don't you give some?
I think it's for us to give a method of exposition. It's for students to work out their own ideas as to where they stand. I take very strong exception, I think, when the academic platform is used as a political platform to encourage students to take a particular political point of view. I think we simply state the problem as we see it. It's up to the students to change the world in their own way.
Right. Well, I think it's time to get a bit controversial, really, here. I think that... It's very unlike Geoffrey Stern to be so judicious, I must say. it's also true that he takes very seriously and very properly, I think, the desire not to preach politics at his audience. But I take the view that although it's a waste of time to preach at people and to try and get them to follow your political line, and it's your proper duty in lectures to try and give us a good account of the knowledge that you think you might have for other people's delectation and critical analysis and so on as possible. That's the best use of the time. Nonetheless, I think it is quite a sharp critique of a lot of social science to get at its supposed value-free nature. And that is as true of realism as it's true of behavioralism and the pseudo-scientific approaches. And I think that it's a strength of the critical theory approach that Martin talked about, and in a different way, Justin, Marxism, that they confront head-on the normative question, and in the case of Marxism, and bring the normative and the positive into a very intimate relationship with each other. And I think David is quite right to ask, partly because it's a very familiar criticism of realism, that it's a static theory and it doesn't have a view of the future, and even more sharply a good question about pluralism, because pluralism can be a bit wishy-washy and lacking a theory of history. Where it's going now and where it should go. Now, I can give you sort of 30 seconds worth of what I think the world ought to become, but that wouldn't be terribly useful. What I think I can do is to try and say what a pluralist analysis of how the world is and how it's going pans out in terms of our view of the sort of medium-term future of international relations. Now, I say right away that I haven't got a single distinctive theory of history. In fact, I tend, I'm afraid, to be rather skeptical and suspicious of theories of history. I think they've cost many thousands and millions of lives in the past. And part of the case for pluralism is to try and make people extremely skeptical of grand overarching systems of ideas which seem to provide the panacea, the way forward, the truth, the way and the light. I don't believe in that. I think that social science isn't about that. In the long run, it may be and it should be about trying to cast more light on things, helping us to make us more critically self-aware and more able to criticize our lords and masters who sit over us as politicians or as big businessmen or whatever. But nonetheless, it is not about holding up some kind of ideal model that if only we have the faith, and I agree with Jeffrey in his remarks earlier about that, then everything will be all right. Now, on the other hand, that in itself can be a straw man, and it's rather easy to criticize those sorts of crusading approaches, and that's not enough. Still, one wants to have a sense of the dynamics of history. It's not just a static process. The kind of pluralism that I think is useful for describing the world wouldn't necessarily have been so useful 100 years ago, and I think that we mustn't agree too much on this platform, that Justin's absolutely right to alert us to the historical particularity of the world in which we always live. My sense of how things are going is that we should recognize the kind of dialectics that exist between, broadly speaking, a very powerful state system which partly lives on in the minds, but in the mind, but then things in the mind are, as we know, some of the most powerful and enduring in history. And the other processes that operate at the level of individual behavior and the various kinds of groups that exist within states and across them. And that to some extent we can use the terms that people like Burton and Rosenau, classic pluralists I suppose, have employed of cobwebs and interdependence and all the rest of it. But I wouldn't, on the other hand, want to take refuge in the view that if we only stick at it long enough, then the cobwebs will entangle the states and they will become bound like Gullivers and the interdependence processes will lead to us all swallowing the same notions of peaceful modernity and we'll all become like New Haven, Connecticut. I don't think it's going to happen like that. I think that there is a slow, painful struggle involved in which the social sciences and in particular can play a useful but not dominant part in helping us to become aware of the ways in which international relations can and is, it's stopping, it's no longer simply a world out there, a mystical world of power and war, something that ordinary people simply end up as objects of rather than as participating in. They are beginning to participate in it slowly by various means, and I think that we can help that process. We can try to demystify international relations, we can help to domesticate it, but by calling it that and holding it up as an ideal, we won't make it so. We have got to try and lay bare the ways in which it is becoming more domesticated and the ways in which it isn't, and in that sense there is still an important role for realism to play in this, I think. Because however much we may identify what in the European community is called the processes of civilian diplomacy, that is to say, influencing people by other means than simply the use of violence or the threat of violence by economic and cultural diplomatic levers and so on, simply by calling attention to the thing and by saying that it's desirable will not make it so. That is the crisis which German foreign policy finds itself in the 1990s. It's not. Civilian diplomacy may be desirable, but it's not enough. That is, to take the view that gradually it is going to be possible to demystify and to domesticate this previously sacrosanct, dangerous area of international relations which only a few hard-nosed professionals could cope with, is broadly speaking the optimistic view that it will be possible, but it's going to be painful and slow and difficult and there are going to be lots of setbacks. The alternative, the pessimistic view, is to say, well, the world of power will reign. It won't reign in the way that it has done in the past, but it will reign in terms of bigger units of scale, bigger economies. There'll be a kind of grand Orwellian regionalism of Europe versus NAFTA versus Japan-dominated Southeast Asia or whatever, and that gradually the same old things of Thucydides and Raymond Aron and so on will turn out to happen, but just between greater, smaller, lumbering units. That is possible. George Orwell wrote about it rather alarmingly, and it could, to some extent, be a self-fulfilling prophecy. It is up to us to act, to analyze, to intervene, to participate. And to that extent, pluralism does bring the normative and the descriptive together.
Question. Right, I think if I weren't misrepresented, I think the question was, can there actually be ever an advance on liberalism in the sense that people will always have to produce for their own subsistence and will always need states to provide security? Some kind of group organization, right. It makes me think, I can't remember who said, somebody said about Marx, that Marx's actual view of capitalism was that it was the worst thing that had ever happened to humanity, and the best. And the reason that he held that it was could be both those things at the same time was that capitalism is actually an extremely contradictory historical development, because on the one hand, there is no denying that in terms of the human ability to produce for our needs and to exercise control over our own development, capitalism is a massive advance on any earlier form of large-scale human society. The problem is that it, as it were, takes away with one hand what it gave with the other, because it secures that enormous productive advance by alienating human agency onto these blind social forces of the market and the balance of power and so on, which we then confront somehow as impersonal external powers that are out to exploit and destroy us and so on. Now, for Marx, the very fact that capitalism was able to show the possibilities of human material progress in that sense meant that it had opened a new epoch in human history, and that if only this enormous productive advance could be, as it were, democratized, then it would indeed be an advance beyond liberalism. And that the very contradictory character of liberalism, that on the one hand it promises all these universal values, but on the other produces inequality on a global scale, somehow people living within that would actually be so, in the long run, overcome by the contradiction of that, that they would press social development forward into a new kind of society that was socialism, which would keep, as it were, the productive advance of capitalism, but without its exploitative forms. So I guess that would be the answer.
Yes.
Thank you very much. It's a very good question. You've enabled me to get my little case study. I think that it's a very reasonable question, and of course the current writing about the European Union is actually dominated by a neo-realist approach to it, or at the very least a neoliberal institutionalist approach, which comes very close to a realist approach. And suddenly I've discovered that well, states actually do still play a role in the decision-making in the Union, and that it's not just a question of integration and spillover and idealism and all the rest of it. Well, some of us took that for granted right from the start, But the converse, that realism can explain all that's happened in this extraordinary adventure called European integration, I think is wholly false. I think it is undoubtedly true that the origins of European integration lie in the nature of the end of the Second World War and a concern for the Franco to bury the hatchet in the Franco-German relationship. That, of course, need was there in 1919 as well. The nature of the settlement or the nature of the Geist did not dispose towards the kind of developments that we got in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s. What we have got is an absolutely unparalleled experiment in cooperation between governments and between peoples, and the setting up of transnational institutions and degree and supranational powers that hasn't been paralleled anywhere else in human history and hasn't been so far emulated anywhere else on the globe. Now, I say this as somebody who was reasonably well known to have taken a skeptical view in the past, and indeed I continue to do, of the hopes for European integration. Partly I do that, though, on the grounds that those many people who pursue European integration as a cause are ending up going in the direction of realism without really knowing it. That is to say, they simply want to build a large Euro state, no doubt a very benevolent and liberal kind internally, with a federal structure. But they haven't thought through the foreign policy implications of it at all. They don't realize that once they've got this damn great entity, which is going to be at least 380 million people in the world, and is going to dispose of a GDP and a potential defense budget far greater than that of the United States, that there are going to be temptations to do something with the power that this entity disposes of in international relations. Now, the true pluralist, in terms of grasping the normative nettle on all this, would say what we need is to develop the processes of international cooperation within Europe without forgetting, and this is where my little hint about connections with postmodernism come in, that by concentrating on yourself and your own internal identity, you sometimes develop at the expense of, as I think it's called, othering other people. That you create your own identity in the light of a distinction from people outside you, the inside-outside distinction, and that can be very harmful. Perhaps we should be moving away from an analysis of international politics, which says that it's simply a question of us and them, even if we draw the boundary now around Europe rather than around Britain or around France or around Germany, whatever it might be. Perhaps we can thicken the web of cooperation in some areas, some issue areas, some geographical areas, while at the same time not forgetting that we are part of a global community, that we are citizens of the world as well as of a particular society, and that multiple identities in this respect at least are not impossible. Now, in terms of an explanation of why it's happened, let me just finish very briefly by saying that I think the realist explanations of US pressure for US integration, the desire finally to create peace and stability in that part of Europe, have a great deal to be said for them. But I think without the extraordinary imagination and talents of people like Jean Monnet, and without the particularities of the institutions that have been set up, with the salami-slicing approach to sovereignty in some areas but not others, I think that we couldn't possibly have the kind of European adventure that actually took place between the years 1950 and the present day. And none of us can actually, with a realist perspective or not, give a very clear idea of the way in which it is likely to go. However firm we think our grasp of international political reality, it is perfectly possible that it will either go on towards a much more federalist but essentially conventional state model, or that it will continue to be a kind of bridgehead towards other forms of international cooperation.
Mm. As you know, the Greeks have just expelled a Dutch and an Italian diplomat for spying. As you probably know, nobody was able to stop the French with their nuclear tests except conceivably Greenpeace. Certainly no other state was able to do it. Britain is not the only country.
Not for realism.
Britain is not the only country which has been selling arms to Iran and Iraq, virtually every other European power has been, rather Western European power, has been competing with virtually every other Western European power to do exactly the same thing. And ask two people in Northern Ireland as to what the boundaries of the United Kingdom and Ireland should be, and you get at least three different answers. I mean, is it really moving towards political unity? I wonder if it were, perhaps we'd have had a policy about Bosnia, but apparently we didn't have a policy about Bosnia, not a unified one, and it wasn't only that the United States failed to come alongside Europe. Europe failed to come alongside Europe. And so I share your skepticism about the integrative tendencies here. There may be integrative tendencies as far as the economy is concerned, but in terms of military and foreign affairs, I don't see it, frankly.
Unfortunately, we have time for only one more question. I think there's one up on the balcony.
Are you saying anything?
Say it again.
Is that one working?
Yeah. Oh. I was just wondering whether Mr. Stern could talk a little bit more about how you can, as a realist, incorporate the idea of Greenpeace influencing a state, and how you so grandly in the beginning said that there were non-state actors that also influenced policies.
Yeah.
They seem to be sort of a strange...
Actually, that was partly a joke, but that about Greenpeace. never mind. Even if we took it seriously, I think what one would have to say, states still have the freedom to choose between the various pressures that are on it. Now, the French, in fact, took, I think it was six, that's right. Originally they said they were going to test eight times. In the end, they tested six times. There are all kinds of pressures on France, not simply from Greenpeace. There were pressures coming from the Australia, from New Zealand, from Tahiti, of course, and from a lot of from Japan, from a number of countries. They simply wanted the French to stop. Now, it is not inconceivable, and I'm afraid I have a slightly conspiratorial mind, it is not inconceivable that all along the French intended only six tests, so that they start by saying eight, and then they make this great present to the world of only having six. It could also be said that in those six tests, probably in the first two tests, they found out exactly what they wanted to find out, but they decided to have six. No, it wasn't, in my view, just Greenpeace. It was a whole lot of different pressures. And in the end, we still don't know exactly why Chirac decided to stop. But the idea that he only stopped because of Greenpeace is really rather absurd. It was a joke. Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry, non-state actors. Well, my view is, as against, I think, a number of pluralists, they're not Chris here, but as against people like Rosenau and Burton, who have no sense of history at all, that they certainly seem to feel, that non-state actors are something very new, something that started around about 1981. Well, have you ever heard of the East India Company? That was one of the biggest non-state actors in the world. It had its own army. Have you ever heard of the Roman Catholic Church? That was that was quite a sizable non-state actor. The fact of the matter is that states have always grown up in a world of non-state actors. Always. There's nothing new about that. But what I complain about is that so many pluralists seem to think this is something entirely new. It's never happened before. My reason for being still a realist, but somebody who feels that states have to take into account all kinds of economic and social and political pressures of all kinds. My reason for being that is that I believe that in the final analysis, a state, provided that it is coherent, has, or rather a government of a state, still has the capacity to choose as to whether it's going to give way to certain pressures or not. That rests with the state. For example, a multinational corporation, so many people are saying the MNCs have taken over from the state. If Cuba wants to nationalize the United States or multinational interests, it does so. If Nasser wants to nationalize the Suez Canal Company, he does so. If Forbes Burnham in Guyana wants to nationalize Booker's Brothers, he does so. I mean, there may be consequences that follow from this, but it is still up to states to determine whether they're going to have multinationals or not, whether they're going to expropriate them or not. My view is that states still have rather more power than many people assume, and that their powers in certain respects are actually growing. Because in the 19th century, states didn't make policy about sporting arrangements, about ideologies, about economic arrangements. Now states have a very close role to play in deciding whether or not private entrepreneurs, sportsmen and so on, are going to be able to do certain kinds of things. So I think in certain respects, the role of the state is actually growing.
Thank you. All speakers will now have the option of making a 2-minute closing statement, and I think we should go in reverse order. So we'll start off with Dr. Rosenberg.
I just want to make two very brief points in closing. First of all, I think one of the besetting problems of international relations theory is its habit of abstraction. When one reads realist writings, and I think listening to Jeffrey talking about the behavior of states, it really does seem sometimes as if states were sort of self-activating entities with their own drives and properties. But they're not. Of course they're not. We know that in the end, they're made up of definite historical individuals, people involved in particular kinds of social relations with each other. And it has to be a fundamental requirement of social theory to understand how that is so, because that's how we, who are the citizens of these states, find out what our responsibilities are, what the forms of our agency in the contemporary world is. And that, I think, is a real strength of Marxism, that it has a social theory of the state in that sense. It actually has an explanation of what kind of society produces the sovereign form of the state that we study in international relations. And the last point I want to make is really a very simple one. Let's not close off the future. Many civilizations have believed that there was nothing after them, that their form of existence was the natural one. And after the Cold War, of course, it looks as if that is the case with capitalism. And we've had more than our share of liberal triumphalism proclaiming that there isn't anything beyond capitalism. But all those other civilizations were wrong. And they were wrong not because the world was just waiting to get to capitalism. They were wrong because it's not in the nature of human existence for things to remain in one way. The point is not whether there is going to be change. The point is it going to be in a progressive direction? And where do we stand in relation to it?
Professor Hill?
Thank you. Well, one of the disadvantages of being a convener of the department at any one time is one's not allowed to attack one's colleagues. One has to be strictly neutral. But I think I'm going to take this opportunity, since they can't answer back particularly, except where Jeffrey's coming next, to attack them very briefly. I think that Jeffrey's account of realism was actually much more attractive than many I've heard, but only because he essentially annexed quite a lot of liberalism into it. And I think he fudged the whole question of what the English school is. I mean, he gave much too much away to the critics of the English school, who tend to say, oh, of course it's realism, they're all realists at the LSE and all that, you know. And of course, the English school is more Grotian. It's much more about rationalism and about society of states and so on. And Jeffrey, of course, believes quite a lot of it himself. So that he has imported or smuggled into realism, no doubt for the heuristic purposes today, quite a lot of that. But I think we should deconstruct it heuristically and make sure that we're aware that there are at least two paradigms in there simultaneously. Now, Justin, of course, is a different kettle of fish altogether. And the only question I would like to put to him, really, although he's not going to have a chance to answer it, at least publicly, is whether or not he needs to be in an international relations department, whether or not he'd be absolutely perfectly happy doing what he's doing in sociology or in economics or in political science, because when you're a Marxist, it doesn't matter where you are, really, does it? It's all the same. You've got your dominant view of the matter, and you just look at international relations through the lens, or you look at society and community and pressure groups through the lens, and so on. And it's very powerful. It's a big theory of history. I've got a lot of time for it, especially the way that Justin does it. But I still haven't heard about the distinctively international relations dimension of it. Well, Mark, As Fred Halliday is always saying, les absents toujours tort, and certainly I think he is wrong in lots of ways. He's very good that he is so inclusive and so critical, but I think that he's throws everything in and doesn't really know, I say he, I mean the critical theory, don't really know how to discriminate and be parsimonious and to identify the factors which they think are critical, crucial, and the factors which aren't. They're also much better on the whole at deconstructing and looking at the biases, that the mobilization of biases that are evident in other people's practice, than in providing us with constructive ways forward or, as I say, parsimonious explanation. The only other point I'd wish to make is that today we haven't really addressed, and I suppose we should have at some point, the question of whether these separate paradigms are in any sense, commensurable, whether we can put them together at all. Now, arguably, there isn't much between common ground between pluralism and Marxism, or shouldn't be between pluralism and realism, although I think Jeffrey managed it, as I say. But in practice, I think that any fair-minded observer would have to acknowledge that you could be, like me, broadly speaking, a pluralist, while nonetheless taking insights without being completely standing on the fence from Marxism or from realism. Indeed, I would think it would be absolutely vital for any creative person to recognize that the paradigm within which they, loosely speaking, inhabit the world is simply a reasonably helpful device for providing intellectual order. And if they think that it is sufficient and that they cannot and should not rearrange their mental maps sometimes by having recourse to things from outside, then they are wholly mistaken. But of course, it's only pluralism which can take such a tolerant view.
I'd actually share that. I mean, I think that I think it's important to be eclectic, as I am, as you actually saw through my little ruse. I think it's important to be eclectic, that there is a place for realism, there is a place for pluralism, and there may be a place for Marxism. I'm not wholly convinced by what I've heard. I can find no place, by the way, for critical theory, to be honest. First of all, I didn't understand it. If I had understood it, I'm not sure that I would have agreed with it. But, one of the things that I find about people who are critical theorists, and up to a point, people who are Marxists, is they talk in this grand level, with this grand level of abstraction. And the important thing, it seems to me, and the first thing I say to any of my students is, if you make a generalization, you have to back it up with evidence. And it's no good making a vast generalization about the working class, or about poverty, or about war, and refusing to tie it down to any specific example. We heard today that apparently poverty, inequality, and war is a matter of capitalism, as if before capitalism came along, there was no poverty, there was no war, and there was no inequality. Of course, that's nonsense. And I think that what is very important is you must never forget, you make a generalization, you back it up with evidence. That doesn't make it true, but what it does is it explains why you hold the view that you do. So do remember that next time you're doing an examination. If you don't give an example, it's bullshit. But if you do give an example, it is something to be proud of. So take that home with you.
It's just bull.
On behalf of the Grimshaw Club, I would like to thank all the speakers, including Mark Hoffman, who couldn't make it to the very end, and you for showing up. Thank you for volunteering your time. Bye-bye.